Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dwayne Dworsky. I am your host for this morning's show. Johnny is not able to be here today because of a family emergency. So I would like to welcome everyone to the weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk show. My guest for this morning is Steve Gorham. He is the executive director of the Climate Science Coalition of America, an independent, non-political association of scientists, engineers, and concerned citizens. They work to inform Americans about the realities of climate science and the economics of renewable energy. Steve is also a columnist for the Washington Times, a speaker on the environment and energy, and former engineer and business executive. Steve and I will be discussing his latest book, The Mad, Mad, Mad World of Climatism. It is an astounding look at mankind and the climate change mania. Good morning, Steve, and welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning, Wayne. Doing great. Great to join you.
It's a pleasure to have you here on the air with me. The Mad, Mad, Mad World of Climatism is a very catchy and clever title. And I have to tell you, the cover design is wonderful. It's quite inviting and puts a nice touch to what is a serious subject matter. The book is well written with lots of details. The charts, graphs, and pictures get the points across quite nicely. Congratulations.
Well, thanks for your kind words.
Oh, my pleasure. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Well, I think my life has been unremarkable. I've always been a Midwest guy. I live near Chicago. Educated at the University of Illinois, and as a master's in electrical engineering, and I got an MBA at University of Chicago. I worked for 30 years in the electronics industry primarily, and married a wonderful woman, Susan, my wife, and had three fine children who are grown up now. And about 4 years ago, though, I decided to attack in another direction, and decided to get involved in the battle about man-made climate and man-made climate change. And along the way there, I wrote two books. First, Climatism, Science, Common Sense, and the 21st Century's Hottest Topic, and then most recently, The Mad, Mad, Mad World of Climatism. I was also asked to be the executive director of the Climate Science Coalition. And I'm a full-time speaker and columnist, and intend to write some more books on this topic and other topics.
Oh, that's great. What is the inspiration behind The Mad, Mad, Mad World of Climatism?
Well, it's a follow-on to the first book, Climatism. The first book is, if I could mention just a minute, it's about it's a 400-page book, hardcover. Discusses the science and the politics and the renewable energy and policy implications of the global warming debate. This book, though, is meant to be a little bit more user-friendly. It has a shorter book, a color paperback, and it was meant to add as much humor as I could. I hired a cartoonist to do some interesting cartoons, and there's 150 color sidebars and lots of zany quotes. The inspiration was to bring a book to people that was really fun to read. I call it the first climate change book that's fun to read. And I think Publishers Weekly captured it pretty well. They call it a colorful and humorous yet science-based book on mankind's obsession with global warming. So that's a pretty good summary.
That was a pretty good introduction. Do you use your writing to express yourself in a public forum or just to entertain others?
Well, yeah, I am a professional public speaker now. I speak to businesses and universities and associations. And then also I'm writing a little column for the Washington Times. I intend to write some more books. So I'm a full-time full-time actor or a journalist in the area of climate change and the environment.
Can you tell us what exactly is climate science?
Climate science is a study of the Earth's climate system, and it's actually a very, very complicated thing.
Okay.
I don't like to call myself an expert in climate science because, as Vaclav Klaus, who's the one leader in the world who's skeptical of the theory of man-made global warming, has said, there are no experts in climate science. Being an expert in climate science is sort of like being an expert in human behavior.
Oh, okay. I can
see that. Topic is very, very big. So I'm a researcher, and I count on a lot of the advances of the other climate scientists.
Okay. Well, we have to count on other people. Why is it important to you to get this story out?
Well, this is something that impacts everyone's lives, every aspect of American citizens' lives, from their business to their automobile, to the food that they eat, to what their children are being taught in school, the effects on their energy, their light bulbs, many, many things are being affected by this misguided notion that mankind is destroying Earth's climate. And so it's important economically and socially and really in many, many aspects of Americans' lives.
Why do you say it's misguided?
Well, because more and more science shows that man-made influences are very, very small and that climate change is natural. And there are many reasons why we got to this position that we can go into this morning.
Okay.
But so that's the astonishing part of all of this situation.
So you think, with all the hype of what's been going on, the tide is turning, the mood is shifting, in other words?
Well, I think it will. I think it is over time. And part of the reason is that the climate is just not cooperating with the alarming projections. We have had effectively no global warming for more than 10 years now, and the projections of the climate models have pointed out that we should have a lot more warming than we're having.
In other words, something should have happened by now.
Right. So the models are not showing what's really being reflected by the real situation. And so I think people are going to catch on that this has all been exaggerated.
It almost sounds like the end of the world, the Mayan calendar end of the world last year scenario.
Yeah, it does in some ways. It's very alarming, the picture that's painted, but we're really not in that situation.
Okay. What were the challenges in writing this book?
Well, first, to write a book with some humor and interesting visuals and cartoons, but also to capture the science and present the science in a way that was down to earth to readers. And then to try and give a flavor of the obsession and the madness of climatism. Climatism, by the way, I probably should define. I define it as the belief that man-made greenhouse gases are destroying Earth's climate, and it is it has become a global ideology in many ways, a worldwide venue or a worldwide method for changing society, and that's all great, except as I mentioned, science increasingly shows that natural effects are the reason for global warming, not man-made influences.
Can you give us a synopsis of the book, like put it in a nutshell?
Well, I'll give you a brief run through it. Chapters 1 and 2 talk about many of the ways that man has been impacting that the belief in climate change has been impacting our societies. Talks about effect on businesses and air travel and food and families, industry, all the things, all the prescriptions for changes that need to be made. So that's captured in also chapter 1 talks about the position of many of the political leaders of the world and many of the scientific organizations. Chapters 3 through 5, I talk about the science in a very down-to-earth way, about the greenhouse effect and about carbon cycle and rising temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter 6, 7, and 8 talk about weather and all the alarm about weather and show that weather really is not different than what we've seen in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Talks about some of what I call the big whoppers of climate change,
mm-hmm.
things like carbon dioxide is pollution, those sort of comments.
And the cyclical nature.
And the cyclical nature, right. I get into Climate Gate, which was the release of emails from the University of East Anglia in England, which is the recognized authority on global temperatures, and how that those emails showed a bias, showed efforts to try and subvert the peer review process, to hide information, to avoid Freedom of Information Acts, and really not proper scientific conduct. Chapter 10, I talk about the impact of money on climate science and what has happened. And then Chapter 11, I talk about renewable energy. That's the longest chapter in the book, and how renewables really are falling short in many ways, even though they've been predicted to be our energy sources for many, many years. They're really not doing it. And then I've got a chapter called Chapter 12 is You Can't Make This Stuff Up. There's a lot of funny stuff in there about all the different wacky things people are doing in schools and governments and everything else. And then a concluding chapter. So that's a basic run-through.
You characterize some influential people in your book as climate prophets of doom. Why is that?
Well, first off, much of the science of man-made climate change is in kind of a prophet mode, if you will. Computer models are run, and they predict warming 40 or 100 years into the future and talk about all the things that are going to happen. We've not seen those things happen to date, either in storms or droughts or floods or species extinction or ice cap melting or any of the things. So most of these things are prophetic. They are predictions.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about some of the leading people that have made alarming claims, former Vice President Gore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask you about Gore. Okay.
Bill McKibben, Dr. James Hansen,
mm-hmm.
Nicholas Stern of the United Kingdom, Tim Flannery of Australia. And so I've labeled them the prophets of doom, and they predict alarming things about oceans and storms and all sorts of things. But we've really, if you look at the history, we've not seen any of that come to pass to date.
Well, I've looked at the waterfront in the New Jersey coastline, and I haven't noticed a difference, really, in the
Oceans have been rising.
They have been rising.
For the last 20,000 years, we've had ocean rise, about 390 feet since the last ice age. And that's a very natural rise.
Mm-hmm.
We've had about 7 or 8 inches over the last century that the oceans have risen. So the oceans are going to continue to rise. It's a natural effect.
Mm-hmm.
But this idea that they're going to rise 20 feet in the next 90 years is not supported by either empirical evidence or any sound science. And that's what Mr. Gore and James Hansen and others have been predicting.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like you're making a very sound argument. One of the subtitles of Chapter 2 is Thin Science for Man-Made Global Warming. Why is that science thin?
Well, it is thin, and it's thin because climate is very complex.
Okay.
We have forces from the atmosphere and from the ocean and from the sun and the planets affecting the climate on Earth. They've been affecting it for many, many years. But the science of man-made global warming boils all that down to about four things. They say, first, we've had rising temperatures. Second, we've had rising atmospheric carbon dioxide. Third, we have a greenhouse effect. All those are true. And then we have computer models that project 40 or 50 or 100 years into the future that say this is going to happen. And so it's a very thin science. There is no empirical evidence, and it discounts, it says that basically a man's comparatively small contribution to a trace gas in our atmosphere, carbon dioxide, mm-hmm. is responsible for man-made climate change, and the major forces of the sun, of the oceans and ocean currents, the weather and clouds, which are actually much bigger forces than the carbon cycle or carbon mm-hmm. dioxide, mm-hmm. Discounts those things. So the science is very thin, yet alarming conclusions are released, are reached, and that is broadcast across the world.
Mm. Also, in Chapter 8, climatism, the ideology behind global warming alarmism. Why?
Now, that's actually a chapter from my first book, but that's okay. In the first book, Climatism,
yeah.
I do talk about the ideology of global warming, and particularly in Chapter 8 and in several other chapters, and the driving forces behind it. And there are many groups that have seized on the idea of man-made global warming to use for their benefit. The United Nations is one of those. The United Nations, if you study their work and read what they have to say, they have some basic things they're interested in. One of those is they would like to equalize the incomes of the nations of the world. They also think that the world is over-consuming and ruining the planet and overproducing. And they were also interested in setting up world government. And a fourth thing is they're concerned about overpopulation. Restricting carbon emissions and the idea that man is warming the planet serves all of those objectives of the United Nations. The European Union adopted approach that man was, you know, accepted that man was changing the climate and allowed that plus many of its environmental efforts to exert greater power over the nations of Europe. The United Kingdom was an early acceptor of the theory of man-made global warming. They wanted to become an environmental leader. Germany in a similar way. We have environmental groups that have adopted it. We have certain industries, wind and coal and biofuels, many consultants. Carbon trading is something that's been adopted by the banks and the other big financial institutions as a way to make money. So there are many, many groups that have relied on the theory of man-made global warming to pursue other objectives, and it has helped build this this worldwide ideology of global warming alarmism.
It almost sounds like a worldwide conspiracy.
Yeah, I really don't like to say that. I give two reasons for it. The first
okay.
is that the world jumped to a conclusion. A climate has always been very uncertain. Back in 1988, Dr. James Hansen of NASA testified in the United States Senate and said he was 99% sure that the Earth was warming and that mankind was causing it. And that very same year, the United Nations formed the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change,
mm-hmm.
and that group promptly found that mankind was the cause of global warming. Many other scientists at the time signed petitions saying, well, we just don't know enough about the climate to make these sort of claims. But the news media ran with the folks that said they were 99% certain, the computer modelers. And then in just 3.5 years later at the Rio de Janeiro Earth Summit, 41 nations signed a treaty saying they would reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So the world jumped to a conclusion first. And then we've had this groundswell of funding from governments across the world, and now we have money that's driving research, driving industries across the world. And so it's kind of a two-fisted approach here. One is jumping to the wrong conclusion. Second, we have money driving everything. And we're just starting to get a little debate to say that, you know, this really isn't the case if you look at the empirical evidence.
Mm-hmm. So, in other words, it sounds like it's the whole worldwide affair is money-driven.
Well, in many ways it is. And again, climate's always been very uncertain. People founded their careers on this idea. We have deans of sustainability at university. Mm-hmm. We have environmental desks at newspapers. We have corporate vice presidents of sustainability. We have all these industries, wind and solar and biofuels, that have sprung up. The banks have been pursuing it with carbon trading. So the U.S. government spends $9 billion a year on research, climate research. It goes to NASA and NOAA, National Academy of Sciences, Department of Energy, Department of Agriculture. And then these organizations give grants to universities across the country to study effects of man-made climate change. And if you're a university, the one thing you must not say is, well, I think climate change is natural, because then you don't get any of the funding. So there's a tremendous network of money that has sprung up behind this that continues to drive it forward.
Yeah, I can see that, yeah. So the global warming is definitely a natural situation, not man-made. And,
well, it looks that that's the case. So let me just break down.
Okay, go ahead.
Let me break down the greenhouse effect for you a little bit.
Okay.
And we have people like Governor Christie of New Jersey that says mm-hmm. he thinks the planet is warming and mankind is contributing. Well, both of those are true. The question is, what is the contribution?
To what extent?
That's the critical question. So if you look at the greenhouse effect, and first thing that people should know is that Earth's most abundant greenhouse gas is not carbon dioxide, it's not methane, it's mm-hmm. water vapor. Hmm. Somewhere between 75 and 90% of the greenhouse effect is caused by water vapor and clouds. Hmm. So if we're conservative, go ahead.
I just wanted to ask, are other organizations acknowledging this?
Yeah, well, this is pretty much accepted.
Oh, okay.
Even Gavin Schmidt, who's a computer modeler, has. And when I present this, I take data right from his scientific paper. He mm-hmm. says 75% of the greenhouse effect is due to water vapor and clouds.
Water vapor.
So if we assume 75% and we take the last quarter, then we have to say, well, how much of that last quarter, now most of the last quarter is carbon dioxide and methane, we have to say how much of that is due to man-made emissions, because the oceans naturally hold 50 times the amount of carbon dioxide dissolved as is in the atmosphere, mm-hmm. and the oceans are always releasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, mm-hmm. and then they're absorbing it. Now, when plants grow, they absorb carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. When they die, carbon dioxide is released. And then we have volcanoes both above the surface of the ocean and under the ocean mm-hmm. who are releasing gases into the environment like carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm. So if you take that last quarter of the greenhouse effect and you say, well, how much is due to man, you find that 96% of that is due to natural emissions. So of the total greenhouse effect, the man-made cause of the greenhouse effect is probably a little bit less than 1% of the total.
That's almost negligible.
Yeah, it is. That means if we completely eliminated all emissions, we probably could not see the difference in global temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
But you never hear that in the press. People just say, warming and man is contributing.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, you know, every time my cat loads up on kibbles and bits, it contributes to global warming, and mm-hmm. it's very, very small. So when people look out the window and they see the sun and they see the rain and the clouds, and if they're near the oceans, they see the power of the oceans and the ocean currents, mm-hmm. those are the dominant factors in climate, not that invisible trace gas that's very, very small that's being blamed.
That's an enlightening point. What is sustainable energy then, and is it the economics of the future?
Yeah, sustainable energy it's really an amazing concept. It has become very much a romantic thing, a propagandized thing. When you look at sustainable energy and you look into it closely, I think you have to question the idea of sustainable energy. The main items are wind and solar and biofuels. All of these things have to be subsidized by the government and have to be mandated by governments, not just in the U.S., but across the world, to be adopted by people in industry. So in that regard, they require subsidies even to be there, not very sustainable. biofuels is the craziest of all of these.
Well,
if you look into biofuels, you find that if you take ethanol, for example, ethanol gasoline, it only gets two-thirds of the mileage of regular gasoline. It actually, studies have shown that it actually emits more pollutants, sulfur oxides, nitrous oxides, ozone, than gasoline does when it's burned. It actually emits more carbon dioxide when it's burned, if you look at the whole cycle, including land use. It raises global fuel prices. It uses huge amounts of water, much more than petroleum production.
And doesn't it use huge amounts of petroleum to produce it?
Well, that's part of it, all the energy that goes into it. So the question is, how did that get to be sustainable? Similarly, if you take wind and solar, if you want to replace a traditional power plant, well, first off, a power plant can't be replaced but by wind and solar because during the night we don't have solar and many times we don't have the wind blowing. But if you just try and even out the average energy of a wind and solar farm versus a power plant, it turns out you need huge amounts of land. For solar, you need 75 to 100 times the land of a traditional coal or gas plant. And for wind, you need 150 to 250 times the land.
Mm.
So, you know, I guess my question is, okay, why is it so sustainable to use huge amounts of nature to provide the same energy? Why don't we build traditional power plants and leave more of nature for nature, more land for nature? So the whole idea of this sustainability is kind of a romanticized concept, but when you look at the economics and the science, it really doesn't measure up with traditional fuels.
Well, can I ask you this? Now I know that that some individuals have solar panels on their roofs. Now, I'm talking about private individuals.
Yep.
Homeowners have solar panels on their roofs and wind generators, and they are able to pretty much do the job for their electrical needs.
Well, they are, except at night. Now, there's a couple things about those things. First off, they're heavily subsidized by government. Typically 50 or 60% is a subsidy. So I, as another taxpayer, are paying for your solar cells. I pay for half of them when they go on your roof. The second thing that's going on, because governments have accepted that this is a thing to do, is a thing called a feed-in tariff. And what they do is allow you to take energy and feed it back into the grid, but not at a level equal to the cost. They give you about a five-time subsidy in most countries of the world. So for every kilowatt you feed back into the grid, you get paid five times the value of electricity at the prevailing market rate. Germany, for example, has built 1 million rooftop solar installations, 1 million of them.
A million.
And they provide less than 1% of the nation's energy.
Mm-hmm.
Yet they've run up, they've guaranteed these feed-in tariffs for 20 years, and they've run up $130 billion liability to people that have put these solar cells on their roof. They're going to have to pay taxes from other citizens to the tune of $130 billion over the next 20 years. So you got to kind of question, you know, Germany, for example, is located, central Germany is located at Calgary, Canada. There's no sun that high. Why are these people putting 1 million solar installations? It's because the German government was paying seven times the typical electric rate for a feed-in. You know, solar is great for call boxes by the highway or heating swimming pools or doing other things.
Mm-hmm.
But when you try and use it for large-scale energy, and
I was going to say on a small scale,
it doesn't do a lot. Yeah,
on a small scale, it might work, but scale for factories and things like that.
Yeah, wind in Hawaii, where it's always very, very windy, it can contribute.
Mm-hmm.
The problem we've got is that the states and the governments are forcing adoption of these renewables and taking taxpayer money to subsidize them. It seems like we ought to just let them compete in the market, and where they're useful, and where they're not. In any case, these things are not going to keep the planet from warming up. that's really a misguided notion.
Your book represents a convincing approach to the climate change problem.
Well, my argument is that people need to do what they've always done for hundreds and thousands of years, and that is adapt to the climate. And we're going to have rising seas. We're going to have a chaotic weather, as we have always done. So we need to to adapt to climate, and that's where efforts ought to be directed. Not thinking we can mitigate climate change by reducing carbon dioxide emissions. That is the thing that's the idea that we can control the storms and we can control the sea level rise, and that's what has no basis in science and almost gets close to superstition. in my opinion.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, you present a pretty convincing argument so far. Let me ask you this now. As a good steward of our planet, where do we go from here?
Well, what we need to do is reduce the real pollution. And by real pollution, I mean ozone and carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, lead, and other things that can cause real harm to people.
And this is from manufacturing mostly.
Well, manufacturing or, when we mine and when we do other things.
Mm-hmm.
But the great news is that mankind is doing that.
All right.
And particularly in the United States, if you look at data from the Environmental Protection Agency, from 1980 to 2009, those six pollutants that I mentioned are down 57%. And our air actually is the cleanest it has been in more than 50 years. We don't have a pollution problem anymore. The worst pollution that the average citizen encounters is from his fireplace or from his campfire.
That's a very interesting point, because I remember years ago, I can go back a lot of years, I would open the window in my apartment in New York City,
yep.
And in the evening there'd be black soot all over the windowsill.
Yeah.
And the air was so laden with smoke that your eyes would burn and you could hardly see down the end of the avenue.
Yeah, that's right. And people used to burn coal.
That's changed. The air is clear and you don't have the dirt on the windowsill anymore.
My grandfather had a coal bin and a coal mm-hmm. chute into his furnace when I was young. And
mm-hmm.
in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, people would burn coal. And when mm-hmm. it would snow, mm-hmm. you know, there'd be coal particles all over the snow, black coal particles after
yeah.
it was there a few days. Well, all that's been cleaned up.
Yeah, so you would say that coal is probably the dirtiest of all the fuels. Coal is definitely the
well,
dirtiest.
Well, and we've even cleaned up the coal now. We have scrubbers on all of our major... we still get about 40% of our electricity from coal.
All right.
Yet it's much cleaner than it has been. We've taken out... just about all the pollutants that have been in the coal when it's burned. So from a point of view of a good steward of the planet, we still need to do that. We still mm-hmm. need to reduce real pollution. We still need to use economical methods of producing energy. But to me, that doesn't mean using 40% of our corn crop and putting huge acreage into production for biofuels.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that is a real question whether that's sustainable or not. It's called sustainable, but doesn't appear to be.
I'm just curious. One of the South American countries, I forget which one it is, has adopted a policy of biofuels, and or I think they're growing corn and extracting ethanol or something from.
Well, you may be talking about Brazil.
Brazil, yeah.
Brazil's getting. Ethanol from sugar cane, which actually may be the only cost-effective way or energy-effective way to produce ethanol, because sugar cane produces very high levels of ethanol with not much energy input. So that might be the one place in the world where ethanol makes some sense. Here in the United States, we can't grow sugar cane economically. It takes about 4.5 gallons of on an energy equivalent basis, when you figure out all the energy that you put in.
Mm-hmm.
It takes about 4.5 gallons of ethanol to replace 1 gallon of gasoline on an energy equivalent basis here. Very, very poor deal. But it's much better down in Brazil. because they put less energy in to get a lot of ethanol out using sugar cane.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we get somewhere between 6 and 10% of our vehicle fuel from ethanol, and we're using 40% of the corn crop. It's not really a good deal.
Oh, all right. You mentioned that we can't really grow the sugar cane in the United States too easily.
Not cost effectively.
Not a practical solution for us. So has this misguided governmental policy addressing climate change impacted business and citizens?
Yeah, it impacts every aspect of what we're doing. We have light bulb bans now to try and get us to stop using incandescent lights.
Mm-hmm.
We have ethanol mandates that forces us to use ethanol, which we get less mileage. You get about 1 to 2% less mileage when you have 10% ethanol in your vehicle.
Mm.
We have now the EPA has made it pretty much impossible to build a coal-fired power plant in the United States, even though that's really the cheapest source of energy. We have the EPA and the Department of Transportation have put into place corporate average fuel economy standards for the year 2025 of 54.5 miles per gallon. Well, the interesting thing behind that, the press always talks about mileage, but if you read those regulations, you see they're all about carbon emissions. That's what's all inside there. So that's all being driven by the fear of man-made global warming. The president has halted the Keystone Pipeline, and we've got a big battle right now about whether that should be approved, because that would bring...
What is the Keystone Pipeline?
Well, it's a pipeline that's to run down from Canada all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. Gulf of Mexico is where we have, near Houston, is where we have all these refineries that refine most of the oil that comes in the United States from the Middle East. So the Keystone Pipeline has the potential to replace 45% of the oil that we import from the Gulf, the Middle East, the Gulf states, 45%. But we have many people blocking it because they say, well, we shouldn't use the Canadian tar sands, oil sands, because they will cause more global warming. So that's a big battle that's raging right now.
That's a new battle, or it's been ongoing?
It's been delayed for 3 or 4 or 5 years. Last year, the president delayed it, and there was just a State Department report out Friday, a 2,000-page report, which basically found it would be unlikely there would be any environmental damage, and the amount of greenhouse gases released would be very small. But many of the environmental groups are up in arms about that report. But there are many, many things going on. Oh, and then finally, all the subsidies for wind and solar, tens of billions of dollars a year are being paid first by U.S. taxpayers to the federal government and then going to wind and solar as subsidies. And then states are forced to build wind and solar by laws called renewable portfolio standards, or the utilities will be fined. And so this raises the cost of our electricity bills, and so the citizen pays a second time, first in taxes, second in higher utility bills. So these policies are impacting just about every aspect of our lives.
Wow. So what was the most difficult concept for you to write about in this book?
I think that the tougher concepts in the book are a little bit of discussion about the greenhouse effect, about the carbon cycle, which is the amount of carbon that's in the atmosphere and then going into the oceans and into plants, the concept of positive feedback, which is the idea that this trace gas carbon dioxide will cause more water vapor to be held in the atmosphere, which will further boost the greenhouse effect. So some of the scientific concepts are a little bit difficult for the readers, but I've tried to provide those in a balanced and down-to-earth way and that most people can understand and grasp.
What touched you most in writing this book?
I don't know if there's a lot of a sentimental thing when you mean touched. I think that the thing that to me was just the wackiness.
Well, I mean, what was you know, like close to your heart? What impacted you? You know, I mean, what did you feel? What urgency did you? You know, what registered in your
Well, the
mind?
Point I the part I really enjoyed was just the wackiness that's going on. For example, here's. I have one section called Breakthrough. Spain produces solar energy at night.
Oh.
Pedro Marin, the Spain's Secretary for the State of Energy, revealed that Spanish solar providers had delivered 4,500 megawatt hours of electricity to the grid between midnight and 7 a.m. Well, when they looked at it a little bit, they found that they had diesel fuel generators running all night and putting the electrical output into the grid and then selling it as solar energy because they would get a tariff that was about 10 times the regular rate for electricity. And then And then we have the problem of Australian camel gas, which is another section. Camel gas. Yeah, there's 1.2 million wild camels that roam the outback of Australia. They're called feral camels.
Okay.
And they munch up the foliage, and then they expel methane from either the nose end or the tail end.
Okay.
Well, you know, and this is supposed to be a global warming problem. And can you believe, December of 2011, the Australian government actually passed an act called the Carbon Farming Initiative Act, which calls for, and I quote, the reduction of methane emissions through the management in a humane manner of feral goats, feral deer, feral pigs, or feral camels. And when they say management, they mean shooting them. So we now have companies flying in helicopters around Australia, shooting camels, and racking up carbon credits. It's all in the name of stopping global warming.
Yeah, but what about all the other animals on the face of the earth?
Well, that's what I was going to say.
Look at all the animals in Africa and,
we could shoot,
and the
we
bears
could shoot,
in Canada and so forth and so on.
We could shoot elephants and we could shoot tigers. We could even probably get the World Wildlife Fund to agree that we could shoot polar bears and reduce emissions. But, you know, these are the goofy things that are going on. So I think what touched my heart was just all the craziness of this world obsessed by a misguided notion that man is causing dangerous climate change.
All right, that's very well put. Okay. Now, what would you like your readers to gain from reading the mad world of climatism?
Well, I think I'd like them to gain that they have to go beyond the headlines, and they really can't, unfortunately, trust their newspaper or their professor or their political leader who's telling them that man's causing dangerous climate change. If they read this book, they'll gain a little bit of an understanding of the science and a lot about the mankind's misguided obsession with this whole topic and then the basics of renewable energy. So that's what I think they can gain, and they'll learn the real facts. I have, there are about 900 notes in this book, and I stand on the shoulders of many, many others who have provided the science for this.
Well, I've certainly gained a lot of insight from your book. Will this book bring a better understanding among the various factions?
Well, I think it'll be a better understanding to all those who read with an open mind. And I don't know about the factions. You know, there are a lot of folks on each side. I try not to get involved in conservative. You know, I never mention in the book Republicans or Democrats or liberals or conservative. It's really not about that. It's about the science and the economics. And so I try, and this is a very politically charged topic, but I try and stay out of the politics as much as I can, except that there are, you know, there's a couple hundred quotes in the book from political leaders and scientists and everybody else on what they say, and some of them are pretty wacky.
Well, they always seem to have a lot to say.
Yeah.
What are some of the lessons we can learn from your book?
Yeah, the lesson, again, is go beyond the headline and the assumption. And the platitude or the ideology, you know, the labels sustainable energy, renewable energy, carbon pollution, and all these things that have been created as labels, and look at what the real science and economics says, and you'll find that a lot of this is not really correct. So that's the main lesson.
Okay. Now here's the $64 million question. Where can someone buy your book? How can somebody get more information about you and keep up with your latest undertakings?
Yeah. The book's on Amazon. It's also in bookstores. And they can also go to my site, which is climatism.net.
All right.
On that site, I have, I think, the best collection of global warming quotes anywhere, I think. I put all the quotes in my first two books on there. I've got a little bit about some boiled-down facts about global warming. And so they can get some information at climatism.net.
All right. And what's next for you?
Well, as I say, full-time, I'm a full-time professional speaker and writing articles, and I'll be writing some more books. And so that's what I used to be a businessman in the electronics industry, but now I call this attacking in a new direction and dealing with the battle for ideas and for correct science, proper economics, and effective public policy.
Can you give us a little foreshadowing of what kinds of articles you might be writing, what kind of speaking you might do?
I do one pretty much every week or every other week in the Washington Times.
All right.
I've got a column called Climatism, so I write on energy, and I write on anything dealing with energy and man-made warming, sustainable development, those sorts of things. There's always something going on that's new and different in this big topic.
And do you have any final thoughts about the mad, I like that title, by the way, mad world of climatism?
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's from the movie with Spencer Tracy in the 1960s.
Oh, the mad.
The mad, it's a mad world.
Yeah, that was an all-star cast, as I remember.
Yeah, it's just, I think people enjoy it. Again, I call it the first climate change book that's fun to read, and I think the people will get a kick out of the cartoons and the 150 colored sidebars and all the other. They'll find it interesting and yet very informative.
Okay. Before we wind down, I just wanted to ask, is there any other anything you'd like to add to any of the questions that I asked you before, the earlier questions?
Yeah, just one thing. I think people need to know that carbon dioxide is the idea that, by the way, the Environmental Protection Agency has declared carbon dioxide a pollutant under the Clean Air Act, and that really is bizarre. Carbon dioxide is not a pollutant. It's one of the, along with oxygen and water, it's one of the three gases that are essential for life.
Yeah.
Carbon dioxide is plant food. We create it in our own bodies. We breathe in only a trace of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, only four molecules in every 10,000 we breathe in. But then we burn sugars in our body, so every time we exhale, we
exhale carbon dioxide
about 100 times the amount that we breathe in. And
Should we start eliminating people because they exhale carbon dioxide?
Well, I just wrote an article for the New York Times.
Kind of ridiculous, isn't it?
Where I talked about how 74 million house cats in the United States are going to put out about 200 times the greenhouse gases of this Keystone pipeline. So, you know, everything that lives creates carbon dioxide, every living animal. It's not a pollutant. So people need to realize that there's a lot of, and the press calls it a pollutant all the time. President calls it a pollutant. It's really crazy.
Well, that's kind of a shortcoming to, you know, think of it that way.
I call it one of the big whoppers of climate change.
Wow, that is a big whopper. Well, you know, I'm really enjoying so much this interview and learning so much about. Climate and climate change, and the fact that it appears to be more of a natural phenomenon rather than a man-made thing. Although we do have a footprint, but it's a very small footprint.
We do, but it's very small.
Yeah. Well, you know, before we wind down, I just wanted to ask you: do you have the show is about recipes for living. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners?
Well, just a little one. I'm not much of a philosopher, and I think people should build their lives on faith and family and integrity, hard work and personal responsibility, and then they need to educate themselves. This whole topic for me has been educational. I never would have believed when I got into it and started studying it that that mankind would be could be headed down such a wrong path. So people need to go beyond the headline, beyond the label, beyond what they hear in the press, and look at it a little bit for themselves to get the real story. And so I recommend my book as a way to get started on that.
I certainly recommend your book, and maybe you want to just tell the listeners one more time about where to get your book and where about your website.
Yeah, my website, climatism.net. They can get a copy of The Mad, Mad, Mad World of Climatism or my first book, Climatism, Science, Common Sense, the 21st Century's Hottest Topic. I'll send them a signed copy. Or they can find it at Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also an ebook out for Apple and for Kindle and for Nook.
Oh, well, that's good to know. Okay. Any other final thoughts?
No, it's been great to join you, Wayne. And
It's wonderful to have you, Steve, and I really appreciate your enlightening talk.
Thanks very much.
I want to thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on My Mom's Kitchen Talk Radio. And to all our listeners, thank you for being with us. And please join us next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Dr. Pamela Weibel. She pioneered the first community-designed ideal medical clinic in America. Her model is featured in the Harvard School of Public Health, newest edition of Renegotiating Healthcare, Resolving Conflict to Build Collaboration, a textbook examining major trends with the potential to change the dynamics of healthcare. Dr. Weibel and I will be discussing her latest book, Pet Goats and Pap Smears, 101 Medical Adventures to Open Your Heart and Mind. The work is helping physicians and patients recapture the joy of medicine. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening and have a great week. And Steve, thank you again and have a great day.
You too, Wayne. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.